Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Alexis McLeod, and Sarah Tyson. Together, we bring conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Kyle Johansson, adjunct assistant professor of philosophy at Queen's University. His new book, Wild Animal Ethics, The Moral and Political Problem of Wild Animal Suffering, is just out from Routledge. Many sentient or possibly sentient wild animals follow a reproductive strategy whereby they have very large numbers of offspring, the vast majority of which suffer and die quickly or suffer and die slowly. Either way, there is a huge amount of suffering in the wild. And it is a truism in ethics that we have a duty to alleviate or prevent unnecessary suffering. If we could intervene in nature to prevent the suffering, shouldn't we? In his new book, Johansson argues that we do have this duty. On his view, the value of unspoiled nature only conflicts with botched interventions, not effective ones. And we already do intervene effectively in ways that do help wild animals, such as through rabies vaccinations that are intended primarily to protect domesticated animals. But through gene editing or other methods, we could do quite a bit more. For example, create a 3-week window from birth whereby newborns do not suffer from pain. Or even, more drastically, turn carnivores into herbivores. Johansson offers a provocative discussion of this relatively neglected issue of animal welfare and also offers some recommendations on how we can address it. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Kyle Johansson. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited about this book. I mean, it was very, very provocative, to say the least. It just raised a lot of really interesting issues and sort of comes to conclusions that make me feel like that can't possibly be the right thing, which is always interesting because it means, you know, that you have to have some, you know, fairly plausible arguments, you know, for conclusions that just seem like crazy, right? So before we get to Wild Animal Ethics, The Moral and Political Problem of Wild Animal Suffering, tell us a bit about yourself, right? What your philosophical interests are, your sort of, you know, how you came to write the book, you know, a bit about yourself as a philosopher.
Okay. Yeah, sure. In terms of my, general background, so I'm a Canadian fellow, grew up in Brampton, which is a suburban city not too far from Toronto. It's about, a 40-minute drive kind of northwest of Toronto. I went to Queen's University. That's where I did my PhD in philosophy. And I studied under Christine Sipnowich and wrote my thesis about a variety of issues in distributive justice. So I'm a political philosopher, but when I was doing my coursework at Queen's, I took a grad course with Will Kimlicka. And at the time, Will Kemlicka and his partner, Sue Donaldson, were in the process of writing a book called Zoopolis, which at this point, if one is someone who does work in animal ethics, one probably knows the name of that book. It's done quite well. And in this course I took with Will Kemlicka, basically what the course was, it was the first time he taught a course like this. And the course was basically just like the manuscript of Zoopolis. So we went through the manuscript and we went through all the different articles that he and Sue had been reading while doing research for the manuscript. And one of the chapters in that book is about wild animals in particular and about the obligations that we owe to wild animals. And it was taking that course that got me thinking about what obligations we might owe to wild animals, particularly in light of the various harms that they suffer in the wild. And that's what got me started working on animal ethics. So now I don't just work in political philosophy. I also do a lot of my work in animal ethics with a focus on wild animals.
Okay, good. Yeah, not, you know, typically, I mean, as you would be aware, you know, a lot of the, you know, animal welfare and rights issues usually deal with domesticated animals, right? You know, factory farms and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it does touch on wild animal ethics as well, but not to this degree. It's generally more specific, I think, in the focus, you know, in terms of saving habitat or something like that. So you start out, you know, being very challenging. You know, what's so great about nature, right? I mean, we all know it's, you know, I think Hobbes, you know, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And I guess, you know, the poverty and the, you know, solitariness is not necessarily true of all animals, humans or otherwise. But you certainly make it clear that for the majority, you know, and I don't know how big a majority that, you know, these numbers are not really comprehensible. You know, life is, as you put it, you know, they have, you know, for many animals, they have a lot of young. It's the, what you call the R strategy, as opposed to the K strategy, which you might explain. So they have a lot of infants. The infants aren't really, you know, get a lot of care. And as you put it, they kind of crawl around for a while, and then, you know, either they die a quick and painful death or a long and slow and painful death. But it both ways, you know, it's like a nasty, horrible, short, hungry, painful life. And so this kind of sets up a basic, you know, problem that, you know, lives like these are usually not, you know, considered to be flourishing lives, and they often may not even be lives that are worth living, right? So this is, this kind of establishes for you a basic argument. So maybe you could tell us just, you know, what's the R strategy versus the K strategy, and what's the basic problem here that you are raising?
Right. Okay. Sure. So, I think this distinction between the R strategy and the K strategy is probably the most, maybe the single most important idea in the book. It's sort of the focus of the book. For people who don't know about these terms, these terms are, I mean, they're a little old actually. Like they were coined back in the 70s, I think, and they're associated with a theory of population dynamics that is no longer accepted, but the terms don't, you don't have to locate the terms within the theory. The terms have just become classificatory terms to refer to animals in species who have certain reproductive behaviors. So you can forget about, like, for anyone who knows about the theories that these terms were associated with, you can forget about those theories. I'm not committed to those theories, and no one who's writing on this subject is. So we're just using these terms in a classificatory manner. And K strategists would be animals who are kind of like us a lot of the time. They're animals who have small numbers of offspring and who devote a large amount of energy into each individual offspring. So K strategist parents devote large amount of energy, a large amount of energy into each individual offspring, and they don't have very many offspring. So we do this. We have, you know, a few kids, maybe we have more than a few sometimes, maybe we only have one, but we don't have that many. No parent has like 100 or 200 offspring or 500 offspring in the human species. And there's lots of animals that are like that too. They'll only have one child, or they'll only have three or four children or whatever. And because they're having so few children and devoting so much energy into ensuring that their children have a decent shot at life. And you know, this energy could be straightforward, kind of just physical or biological energy. So case strategists often have offspring that are larger and more well-developed upon birth. Like they've already gone through quite a lot of physical development upon birth. But the energy can also be social energy. So lots of case strategist parents don't just give birth to larger, more well-developed offspring, but they'll actually care for their offspring for a long period of time to the point where their offspring are relatively competent and able to manage dangers on their own. Case strategist offspring, they have a reasonably decent shot at life because so much energy is devoted into each individual offspring. A case strategist infant is, depends on the species, but relatively likely, certainly more likely than our strategist, than an our strategist infant, to reach maturity and reproduce. The R strategy is just the opposite kind of the case strategy. The R strategy, our strategist parents don't have small numbers of offspring. They have very large numbers of offspring. In the case of small mammals who are our strategists, this would often be something like dozens of offspring. But in other species, like fish species, it could be thousands or millions of offspring. And the idea is to just play a kind of numbers game here. So, I mean, in nature, animals are trying to protect their genes. They want it to be the case that they have some offspring who survive to maturity and reproduce, because then their genes get passed on. And one way of ensuring this, one way of ensuring that your genes get passed on, is to just have as many offspring as possible. Because if you have, you know, like 1,000 offspring, then even if those offspring are terribly incompetent and are getting eaten all the time and are starving, some of them will survive. Like a few of them will probably survive and reach maturity and reproduce. And so that's how the R strategy works. And if you're, you know, someone who does work in animal ethics and you think, you know, sentient beings are morally important, they have, you know, interests that we ought to take into consideration when deciding what our obligations are. If you have that kind of stance and you think about wild animals and the way they reproduce, you should be really, really disturbed by the way things work in nature, because it means that wild animals are doing really, really badly for the most part. Like most individual wild animals are either not living flourishing lives at the very best, or they're not living lives that are worth living at all. Because most individual animals are our strategists, right? There's various case strategist species, various R strategist species, but because R strategists have such higher birth rates, most individual animals born into the world are R strategist animals, and they're living these sorts of lives, really short lives, where they die either from, you know, predation or from starvation or from exposure or from dehydration or from disease. If you think individual sentient animals are morally significant, this state of affairs should be something that really, really disturbs you. And that thought should prompt you to wonder whether there's anything we could do about it. Because if there are things we can safely do about it, then presumably as a matter of beneficence or humanitarian assistance, we ought to do something about it. And that's the main idea in the book, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, good. So, you know, we'll get to the question, you know, can we do anything about it, you know, or should we first before the can? So you mentioned sentience, and that's, you know, so a lot of the R strategists, and we're talking about lots of species in nature, well, you know, when we think of case strategists, we're thinking probably of the, you know, I don't know, megafauna, things like that. We're not thinking of, sea turtles or fruit flies or, you know, I don't know. I don't know where rabbits would fall in this. I guess the rabbits would be an R strategist, although they do take care of the young to some extent. So I don't know. But in any case, the sentience aspect is not trivial, and it's also very questionable. Like where you know which of these many our strategists are plausibly sentient. So maybe you could give example of your typical or many our strategists and where do they plausibly fall in the sentience line?
Right. Okay. So, I know you didn't phrase it as an objection, but this sort of thought is often like one of the first objections that occurs to people when they're presented with the idea of wild animal suffering and the various facts associated with it. The objection more or less that often people put forward is, well, look, the R strategy sounds like it's terrible. If we assume that R strategists are sentient, but aren't most R strategists not sentient? I mean, insects tend to be R strategists. Insects have, it depends on the species, but a lot of insect species have very, the parents will have very, very large numbers of offspring. And it's really unclear which insects are sentient, which ones aren't. I mean, insects are invertebrates. They don't have central nervous systems or ones that kind of do. They're not anything like ours. But because insects are invertebrates, it's unclear whether they're sentient. They might be, but we don't know. There's like a high level of uncertainty with respect to whether most insects are sentient. And this is true of some other R strategists too. Amphibians tend to be R strategists, and I think it's fairly clear that adult amphibians are sentient. But a lot of amphibians, their young, go through a larval stage when they're born, and it's unclear whether larval amphibians are sentient because their level of cognitive development is fairly minimal. And a lot of the R strategists, amphibian infants who are dying would have been in their larval stage when they die. These sorts of questions make it's worth wondering, to what extent the death of R strategists involves the death of the sort of painful death of sentient beings. I think this sort of uncertainty is important, and I think it would be hasty for anyone who cares a lot about wild animal suffering to conclude that most R strategists are sentient. I don't think that it's clear that most R strategists are sentient. It may be the case that most of them aren't. But one thing I think that is clear is that most sentient individuals born into the world are R strategists. So the thought here is that the R strategy is a really quite common reproductive strategy. It's not just common amongst amphibians and amongst insects. It's common amongst lizards. It's common amongst mammals. Like a lot of small mammals are more or less R strategists. They're R strategists to a lesser degree than sea turtles are or fish are, but they're still much more R strategists than we are or than large mammals are. And just given how common the R strategy is, it seems like it's almost certainly the case that even if the scope of sentience ends up being fairly narrow. So for example, suppose that we, I think, implausibly assume, because I think this is probably false, but suppose that we implausibly assume that only mammals are sentient. We have a very conservative view of sentience. We say we know mammals are sentient, but we're going to say that other animals aren't. Even if that were the case, even if only mammals were sentient, it would still be the case that most sentient individuals born into the world are R strategists. And the reason is because most mammals born into the world are R strategists. It's not necessarily the case that most mammalian species are R strategists, but most individual mammals born into the world are R strategists. And this just follows from the fact that R strategists have far, far higher birth rates than K strategists do. I think people working on wild animal suffering should acknowledge that it might be the case that most R strategists aren't sentient, but they should nonetheless emphasize that it seems to almost certainly be the case that most sentient individuals born into the world are R strategists. And so it's still going to be true that most sentient individuals live lives like this. They live these really short lives where they die from a really, really painful cause.
Good. Okay, yeah. Good. So then like rabbits would be R strategists.
Yeah, I don't know enough about rabbits to comment on rabbits in particular. I think it's worth keeping in mind that although it's sort of convenient to talk about the R strategy and the K strategy as if it's a dichotomy between two just completely different concepts, That convenience is inaccurate, or it gives one a misleading impression of how it works. It would be better to think of it as a spectrum where you might think of like Uber case strategists on one side of the spectrum and then kind of like Uber R strategists on the other side of the spectrum. Like an Uber case strategist would be a case strategist that normally only gives birth to one or two offspring over the course of their entire life. And those offspring usually survive. Like it's very rare for them to die. And I think blue whales are like that. Blue whales have very, very few offspring. I'm not an expert on whales or anything. And then Uber R strategists would be like sunfish. Sunfish sometimes lay like millions of eggs. So you would see that. And then there's tons of stuff that sort of falls in between. And you know, rabbits are probably more R strategists than we are, but they're probably more case strategists than certain other small mammals, and certainly more case strategists than like sea turtles or fish.
Okay, so, good. Okay, that was helpful. So you might say, that's, you know, nature's red in tooth and claw, and that's just kind of the way it is. I mean, you know, nature is just that way. How does this become a moral obligation on our part? Could you explain that? You know, to do something about this. I mean, to intervene in nature. I mean, that in itself. I mean, this was one of the, you know, sort of confounding, you know, issues in the book is that you end up arguing for this really, really kind of extreme ways of intervening in nature. And when many, you know, animal, you know, rights activists and welfareists and everything are all like, you know, we should not be intervening in nature. We should try to get more, you know, habitat and stay out of it and let it do its thing. And you're kind of doing like just the opposite, which is so bizarre. So why do you, there is this, you know, nature red in tooth and claw, as I said that. And, you know, it's like, but that's just nature. I mean, we should just let nature run its course. These different strategies are both successful, and, you know, we shouldn't intervene. I mean, what is the duty that we've got to here? Why should we feel that we have any obligation to inject ourselves into nature as opposed to, you know, pulling ourselves back?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. One of the chapters in the book is about the view that nature is good, because it's really common. It's a really common view that a lot of people hold the view that nature is good. And I think that there's kind of two different thoughts wrapped up in the view that nature is good, and they're distinguishable, but they're also connected to each other. One of those thoughts is that nature is good because wild animals are living decent lives. I think a lot of people don't actually know that wild animal suffering is so bad. I think it's a matter of common knowledge that, you know, predation exists, and that there's a certain amount of other dangers that wild animals have to face, like, you know, parasites, and maybe they get diseases sometimes or whatever. But I think that by and large, a lot of people, when they think about what it's like to be a wild animal, they're imagining a life that's reasonably good. And I think certain practices presuppose this. So if a wild animal is injured, a lot of people would say, you know, you should rehabilitate that wild animal, and then, you know, release that wild animal back into the wild where the animal belongs and where the animal will be happy, or something like that.
Or other people will say that's just part of the natural cycle. Whatever's going to happen to it, let what's happened, because that's just part of nature.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So I think the view that nature is good, I think there's two parts of it. Well, one part of it is I think a lot of people really do think that the wild animals are typically living decent lives. And I think the other part of the view is that naturalness is a valuable property. And that's a little bit different from just saying that wild animals are living decent lives. So the view that naturalness is a valuable property. I mean, we can predicate naturalness of lots of different things. We might say that a space is a natural space, you know, attractive wilderness, insofar as it hasn't been affected too much by human activity, is natural. We might say that some products are natural products. So you can, you know, you could have a natural food product that's, you know, and we contrast it with synthetic food products, or you could have a natural cosmetics or something like that that you would contrast with synthetic cosmetics. So you can predicate naturalness of lots of different things. And I think it's popular to think that naturalness is, insofar as something is natural, then just all things being equal, that's good. Like naturalness makes something more valuable than it otherwise would be. So in the book, I criticize these views. I think these two sort of different but interrelated views. And the reason I think they're interrelated is because one might think that there's a connection between the welfare of wild animals and the naturalness of wild animals. So I think that some people think that if you try and intervene in nature, you'll just make to benefit animals or not to benefit animals, to do other things, you'll tend to make wild animals' lives worse. And I think that creates a kind of clear connection between the claim that naturalness is a valuable property and the claim that wild animals are better off without us, at least, that they should be left alone. But anyway, I criticize these sorts of pro-nature views in the second chapter of the book. One sort of criticism is just what I've already mentioned. I think that a lot of people aren't fully aware of how pervasive and severe wild animal suffering is. It doesn't occur to them that if you really think about the way reproductive strategies work, it follows that the vast majority of sentient individuals born into the world live these really short, nasty lives. So I think that's one thing. And I think the reason why this doesn't occur to people, there's probably more than one explanation for why a lot of people just haven't thought about the implications of the R strategy. But one explanation for this is that R strategists, particularly R strategist infants, are easy to ignore. They're not very noticeable to us. When we think of wild animals, we tend to think of animals that are more like us. They're big. They are sociable. They're kind of charismatic. They have personalities. They're cognitively advanced. These are the ones we kind of notice. And those sorts of animals, like large mammals and whatnot, are not representative of wild animals. They're really just a very, very extremely small fraction of the wild animals who are born into the world. And insofar as we ever do think of our strategists, because sometimes we do imagine our strategists, sometimes you might think of, a crocodile or a bullfrog or something like that, if you're imagining a wild animal. Insofar as we do think of our strategists, I think that we normally think of adult our strategists rather than infant our strategists. When you're imagining a crocodile, you're probably not imagining the little sort of tadpole-ish thing that the crocodile originally was when it was born. But adult R strategists are just as unrepresentative of wild animals as K strategists are, because the vast majority of R strategists don't live to maturity. They die during infancy, rather. So I think we have this tendency to notice certain animals more, maybe because they're more like us, or maybe because large survivors are just more obvious. When you walk around, you don't notice little tadpole corpses. You notice the crocodiles walking around with the bullfrogs hopping around. You notice the survivors rather than the ones who died. And this is just a cognitive bias, I think, produced by either by the just visibility of survivors, or maybe by our tendency to notice animals that are more like us, more so than we notice animals that are unlike us. And it produces an unrepresentative picture of what life is like in the wild.
That's fine. So, but okay. It's like, why do we need to, why do we have some sort of a moral obligation or duty to intervene in this situation?
Right. So with respect to, I think there's kind of like a straightforward answer, and then there's more complicated answers that would have to address objections and things like that. But the really straightforward answer is just that. So if you assume that that wild animals are morally considerable, that their interests matter, including their interest in continuing to live and their interest in not suffering. And if we combine that sort of moral considerability with the fact that wild animals are living these atrocious lives, well, then it seems like we have duties of beneficence to do something about it. I think that's a very kind of simple moral argument for intervening. But in relation to naturalness, one of the things I argue for in chapter two is that insofar as naturalness is, it makes sense to think of it as a valuable property. Because if it seems like naturalness being a valuable property is a bar to intervention, right? If naturalness is valuable, intervening impedes upon naturalness or decreases naturalness. Insofar as we intervene in nature, we make it less natural. Because that's all the concept of naturalness is natural things are things that occur or exist independently of human agency. So if we're going out into nature and messing around with it, we are making it less natural. And if naturalness is valuable, then we are reducing a value by doing that. And so when talking about the idea that naturalness is valuable, I argue that the best way to understand naturalness's value is in terms of, I think the kind of value it has is extrinsic value that comes from our epistemic limitations or is associated with our epistemic limitations. So I think the sense in which naturalness is valuable is that natural states of affairs are better than non-natural states of affairs produced by botched interventions. And botched interventions are just interventions where you might have tried to do something good, but you made things worse because you didn't understand the natural processes you were intervening in well enough. And natural processes can be terribly complicated. Ecosystems are terribly complicated things. And anytime you intervene in an ecosystem, there's a chance that there'll be some kind of chain reaction that maybe harms a lot of wild animals or harms human beings or whatever. And there's other ways in which we can botch interventions too, I think. I think when surgery first came around, people were pretty freaked out about it. I remember reading about this when surgery was first advocated as like a potentially desirable medical intervention. People thought it was this crazy idea because your surgery involves cutting into the human body and removing a part of it, and that just seems like it's just maybe it's well intentioned, but you're just going to kill people by doing that. And at first, that was probably a really reasonable worry because surgeons maybe didn't know what they were doing at first. I think this sort of thought makes sense. The thought that natural states of affairs are kind of complicated and maybe they're not entirely optimal, but if we try and make them better, we'll mess up and make it worse. I think that thought makes sense, and it creates a kind of value associated with naturalness. So natural states of affairs are comparatively valuable when you compare them to non-natural states of affairs that are produced by botched interventions. But this kind of value goes away as soon as we learn more. So when surgeons learned how to do surgery really well, it stopped being the case that being sick was better than being operated upon. Being sick was only better than being operated upon when operating on you would had a high chance of killing you. But when that goes away, once we learned how to do surgery better, that value's gone. And I think the same is true of other interventions. With respect to any particular intervention in nature, as we learn more about it and get more practice and get better at doing it, it becomes the case that we can do it more reliably and get better at producing good outcomes. And I think that's all we need to do in order to intervene in nature in a way that's morally good.
Okay, good. So let's get into your suggested interventions, because this is, I think, makes everything a little bit more concrete. Let's assume there are lots of wild animals that are suffering and they're living awful lives, or maybe even lives not worth living. I don't know. If that difference will make a huge difference. But anyway, so there is some prima facie case for intervening to prevent suffering, right? And if naturalness is just, kind of basically fear of messing it up in some way, making things worse, well, once we know more, then, if we knew which sorts of interventions might actually improve things and relieve some of the suffering, then, we ought to do them. So what are the sorts of interventions that you kind of have in mind?
Sure. So So I think that there are some, and I don't talk about, there are some interventions that I think are very good, but that I don't talk about much in the book because I don't think they're as philosophically interesting as other ones. So some that I think are just obviously good and which other people like to talk about would be sort of medium scale interventions that, that we're already doing, but which we could be doing more of for the sake of wild animals. So some of the things that we already do is we already vaccinate wild animal populations against diseases when those diseases negatively affect our interests or negatively affect the interests of domesticated animals. So it's fairly common to vaccinate, using feeding stations and whatnot, to vaccinate wild animal populations against rabies, because rabies can negatively affect human beings, and it can, when human beings are near a wild animal population, and it can negatively affect domesticated animals. And so it's common in, for example, the United States and in Canada to vaccinate wild animal populations against rabies. And we're not doing it for the wild animals. People who are doing this aren't thinking, well, right, rabies must be really bad for wild animals. Let's help them. They're doing it because they want to help us. We're helping ourselves by doing this. But inadvertently, kind of, or as a bonus, it does in fact help wild animals. Like, rabies is not good for the animals that gets it, that get it. It's a very uncomfortable disease that can kill the animals that get it. So we could just be doing more of that kind of thing. I mean, if we're already vaccinating wild animal populations against the diseases that threaten us, we could vaccinate them more comprehensively against diseases that maybe don't threaten us, but just threaten them. And we could do other things too. We could start eliminating, for example, non-sentient parasites, or at least reducing the populations of non-sentient parasites that plague wild animals. And that's another thing that we've done in the past, actually. In the year 2000, I think it was, we managed to eliminate something called the screw fly from North America. And the screw fly is this fly that lays eggs in wounds within living mammalian hosts. And the eggs hatch, become maggots, and the maggots eat the host alive. And it's really, really nasty. It's debilitating, painful. And eventually it tends to kill the animals that become infected. And we got rid of the screw fly in North America around the year 2000 because it was negatively affecting us. It was affecting farmers' profits. It was sometimes harming people who lived in, I think, rural communities in the United States and in Mexico. And so we managed to get rid of it. So we did it for human reasons, but by getting rid of the screw fly, we massively benefited mammals that live in North America, because, like, wild mammals that live in North America, because it wasn't mostly human beings and domesticated animals that were being affected by the screw fly. It was wild mammals that screw flies were mostly plaguing, and wild mammals' lives are now better because we got rid of the screw fly. We could just do more of this sort of thing for wild animals' sake. We could start eliminating parasites that may not affect our interests at all, but specifically the ones that affect wild animals' interests. And I think that these are kinds of the most obvious things we could do. But they're also, sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
No, go ahead. Cause,
okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So these are the obvious things to do, I guess. But they're also, because they're obvious, they're less philosophically interesting. And so in the book, the ones I talk about are interventions that we could carry out through gene editing. So gene editing has become really advanced. The most recent sort of major advancement in gene editing, arguably, was the development of a technique called CRISPR. CRISPR is really cool because it's way cheaper to use than other gene editing technologies were. So cheap, in fact, that amateurs can use it, and you don't need to be at, like, a university or in a well-funded private lab to use CRISPR. You can buy, like, CRISPR kits and do your own little CRISPR experiments in your basement if you feel like doing that. And so people do things like, they produce fluorescent yeast using CRISPR kits and things like this. You can buy them online. And so the other cool thing about CRISPR, though, is that it's super cheap. It seems like it's capable of creating lots of different traits. We've already used it to do a bunch of different things. So, for example, it's been used to create hornless cows. It's being used in agriculture to some extent. Hornless cows were created using it. Cows that are resistant to tuberculosis were created using CRISPR. CRISPR was used to create mosquitoes that don't carry the malaria parasite, that are incapable of carrying the malaria parasite. That's already been done in the laboratory. CRISPR has been used to create, or sorry, I'm not sure if CRISPR was used for this, but other earlier gene editing technology, at least, was used to create mice that are incapable of suffering. And it's certainly the case that CRISPR could be used to do the same thing.
They could feel pain.
They could feel pain, kind of, but they couldn't suffer. So there's a distinction that I draw in the book between dimensions right. of pain.
Yeah, that's right.
This isn't a distinction that I came up with. It's something that is pretty commonplace now. But so there's a distinction to be made between one's sensory experience of pain and the affective dimension of pain. So one's actual the feeling of pain that one has when a painful experience occurs versus the extent to which one's pain bothers you, or the extent to which your pain bothers you. The thought is that suffering is a bit of both. In order to suffer, you have the sensory experience of pain, but your pain also really bothers you a lot, enough so that maybe it prevents you from doing other things you want to do and makes your life really bad. But what happened with these animals is they were designed with the mice in these experiments is that they were made to not care much about their pain. A particular part of their brain was affected so that even though they could still experience pain and even though, they cared about it enough that they wanted to avoid it, it didn't bother them that much. It didn't reduce their quality of life nearly as much as pain normally would. I don't know. I'm kind of rambling about things.
You've raised a number of these, intervention types, and I think each of them, sort of individually sounds, has some plausibility to it. But so when you talked about eliminating the non-sentient parasites, right? You might as well just say. Let's just eliminate all the problematic species, whatever, that are probably don't feel anything, just kind of get rid of that whole thing, it seems like the obvious, problem there is just going to destabilize the whole ecosystem. And then on the other hand, with the gene editing thing, it's like, fine, sort of, but, now again, you're kind of getting into issues about, it's not a matter of say, and I remember reading this in a paper, about where chickens that were, deliberately blinded. I don't know if it was by CRISPR or some other genetic manipulation, maybe just breeding. Chickens who are blind don't suffer as much from the overcrowding in your typical, poultry raising operation. So let's just, raise these, blind chickens. That sounds horrible. When we're just talking about domesticated animals, but now we're talking about intervention in the genetic of wild animals. And that seems to be if anything worse. And I don't, so there's, one is the problem of, if you intervene in the one way, it seems like, massive ecosystem collapse is almost, inevitable. On the other hand, you've got this, maybe it's just an intuitive moral, repulsion. You're intervening on these animals to, change them from carnivores to herbivores, or eliminate their capacity to suffer, or something along, some very, very significant. These are not minor interventions. These are major interventions into the whole lifestyle of the species, and that seems wrong as well. So, how do you respond to those two problems?
Okay, sure. You brought up the thought that one option, if you wanted to intervene in nature to reduce suffering, one option is you could try and get rid of wild animals because if they're not around, they can't suffer. And in particular, if our strategists are. If your average R strategist is living such a bad life that it's not even worth living at all, you'd benefit R strategists by reducing their population sizes, by preventing them from reproduce, from reproducing, because most of them are better off not being born. So I think one thing I think that is worth doing, and it reflects the thought that our strategists, infants, probably don't live lives worth living. One thing that I think is worth doing, if we could do it safely, would be to find ways to lower our strategists' birth rates and to make the young that are born more resilient, so that they're more likely to survive and reach maturity and reproduce. And if we were to do this sort of thing with our strategists, that would be really just the same thing as turning them into case strategists. Because what makes something an R strategist versus a case strategist is just how, you know, the size of their litter or the size of their clutches, combined with the amount of energy that's invested into each individual infant. So if we could just get our strategists to produce fewer infants and to invest more energy into them, that's just the same thing as turning them into case strategists. And I think this is something we could try to do with gene editing. But I also think that a lot of research would be needed to make it safe. And it may turn out that we wouldn't be able to do anything like this on a large scale safely. I think it's unclear, because I mean, hypothetically, you know, obviously if you're doing something like reducing our strategists' litter sizes, then that's going to have ecological repercussions. There'll be, for example, fewer our strategist babies for predators to eat. And so predators might end up going hungry or something like that. And so, but you know, with CRISPR being so amazing, maybe we could do things to help the predators to try and offset the ecological consequences of reducing our strategists' litter sizes or clutch sizes. So maybe we could find some alternative food source for predators. Maybe design a plant that predators would find attractive and would be able to eat or something like that. We could try to do this with gene editing. But it's worth thinking about. These sorts of possibilities, I think. And I think it's also, just given how bad wild animal suffering is, I think we have strong moral reasons to do the kind of research that would be necessary to figure out, you know, whether these kinds of interventions are feasible and whether they could ever be done in an ecologically safe manner. I actually don't know whether those sorts of dramatic interventions are either feasible or safe, but I think it's worth figuring out whether they're feasible or safe. With respect to some of the other potential interventions, you mentioned removing the capacity to suffer. That's something else I consider in my chapter on gene editing. I think that one is less iffy than trying to change species behaviors. Trying to do something like changing carnivores into herbivores or changing our strategists into case strategists, that would have massive ecological probably repercussions. And so it's, you know, that people are, I think, reasonably skeptical about such interventions. So removing the capacity to suffer from certain animals, that one, if done correctly, would make a huge difference. And I think it probably is much less risky. So what I have in mind is, I mentioned there's this distinction between mere pain and suffering. So when one suffers, one doesn't just have the sensory experience of pain, but also cares a lot about the pain that they're having. Their pain bothers them a lot. And it's possible to remove, we've already done it in the laboratory, right, with mice. It's possible to remove the capacity for suffering without removing the capacity for mere pain or just the sensory experience of pain. So you can leave intact feelings of pain and also the sort of avoidance behavior associated with that, while also removing the capacity for suffering. And particularly if we could do this for just a period of our strategists' lives. So if we could make it the case that our strategists young are unable to suffer for, say, like the first 3 weeks of their lives or something like that, that would make it the case that they're not going to suffer during the period of their lives where they're most likely to be experiencing harms and most likely to die a really terrible death. It would be kind of like this, just the same thing as giving them a big genetic Tylenol or a big genetic shot of morphine during the period of their lives where they're most likely to die really terribly. Maybe there would be some ecological repercussions associated with that, but it's hard to see what they would be. And if there were ecological repercussions, they'd probably be way, way smaller, way less pervasive than the sorts of repercussions that would be associated with turning our strategists into case strategists or carnivores into herbivores. And so although it might seem counterintuitive to say that we should, you know, temporarily remove the capacity to suffer from our strategists, I think the only reason it seems so counterintuitive is because we have it stuck in our heads that naturalness is a good thing. So even if I successfully argue, as I hope I do in the book, that naturalness only has this particular kind of extrinsic value associated with it that comes from our epistemic limitations, even if I'm right about that, I'm not going to change people's intuitions by just arguing that. Like, it takes, you have to, changing your intuitions takes a while. You have to think for a while and reflect on your emotional reactions to different things. So I think, really the only reason it seems so crazy, it might still seem crazy to, or counterintuitive to temporarily remove suffering from our strategists, is just because it seems unnatural, and that's kind of weird for people.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, you know, there's plenty of suffering outside of that. But so I guess the idea is, yeah, yes, but this would prevent a great deal of it. Is that the idea? That's right.
Yeah. So, okay. One thing I'm sort of conscious of doing throughout the book is distinguishing between ways in which interventions can be good. So I think that removing the R strategy, so turning R strategists into K strategists, or turning carnivores into herbivores, I think that you might sort of associate that kind of implementation or that kind of intervention with maybe ideal theory. So you might think a state of affairs, you know, an ecosystem where there were only herbivores and where there were only K strategists, an ecosystem that was like that and that functioned well would be an ideal ecosystem. And if we could ever bring such an ecosystem about without violating a whole bunch of deontic constraints on the implementation of ideals, if we could ever do that, that would be a great thing to do. But it's unclear whether we could do that, or if we ever can do it, we might not be able to do it for all ecosystems, maybe only for some. And that's the kind of view I have about behavior change, about changing our strategists into K strategists or carnivores into herbivores. Mm-hmm. With respect to the temporary removal of suffering, that's a much more kind of ground level intervention. I'm not doing some ideal theory there. That's actually something that I think is probably feasible and something that, you know, we could technically that we're able to achieve given what we've already done with gene editing technology. And I think it's also something that's probably safe because I don't think it would have really very major repercussions on ecosystems where we do it. As long as it's temporary, as long as you can make it the case that our strategists will regain the ability to suffer after a few weeks, the ecological repercussions are probably fairly small, given that they would still be able to feel mere pain. They'd still have various avoidance behaviors. I think maybe in the sort of medium term or something like that, that kind of intervention is really promising.
I mean, it certainly sounds more plausible than the others. Just seem like so massive, like basically mean, yeah, you know, we just need to change the makeup of the entire natural world with intention rather than, you know, the way we're doing it now through global warming. Obviously the actual practicalities of carrying it out, but I mean, at a purely sort of hypothetical level, it seems like, yeah, you know, if there were kind of a way to spray something, you know, over the entire globe, that would accomplish this. You know, why would we not do it, right? Well, so is this the sort of thing that, you know, I mean, you know, like I mentioned before, I mean, these sorts of considerations are just not on the radar pretty much for, you know, animal welfareists or, you know, advocates. You know, when it comes to wild animals, what you're talking about for with nature, you know, is something we should, you know, preserve as it is, right? We want to set aside land. We want to keep the humans out and let nature do its thing because nature is good, right? So if you're right, you know, and we should be exploring these, you know, some sorts of, like, you know, much more active intervention and not this hands-off strategy that people seem to think, you know, is that, I mean, should advocates of animal welfare and things start, you know, kind of transferring their energies to this as opposed to something else? Or what they already do?
Right, okay. So my view on that is that right now it probably would be unwise for animal advocacy groups to be advocating for anything too dramatic. So, suppose that a bunch of animal advocacy groups decide that that wild animal suffering is a big deal and that we should do something major about it to try and remove it. I think it would be, given just the state of like public opinion right now and how counterintuitive people find ideas like turning our strategists into case strategists or turning carnivores into herbivores, I don't think it makes a whole lot of sense for advocacy groups to start pumping out pamphlets that advocate for those things or anything like that. Because I think people would just be like, oh, the animal rights view is ridiculous if it implies this, or, you know, caring about wild animals is ridiculous if it implies these sorts of interventions, and it'll just turn people off. They won't pay attention, and there's just a lot. There'll be a lost opportunity for doing some good there. So I think the best thing for advocacy groups to be doing right now is doing groundwork kind of stuff. So I think a certain amount of work needs to be done before we could successfully advocate for large scale, something like large scale genetic interventions in nature. And I think the kind of groundwork is already being done. So advocacy groups are already doing things like trying to get people to go vegan. They're already trying to get people to appreciate that sentience matters, that it arguably is the right criterion for inclusion in the moral community. I think that, you know, these sorts of advocacy efforts, advocacy for including animal, for accepting that sentient animals are part of the moral community, advocacy for changing your own behavior so that we're not contributing to like really massive anthropogenic harms to animals as much. I think that this kind of advocacy is useful for changing people's attitudes and behaviors in ways that probably will make them more likely to care about wild animal suffering at all. So if you're someone who accepts that animals are part of the moral community, that sentience makes a being morally important, and if you've done the work necessary to sort of resolve cognitive dissonance and change your behavior so that you're not harming animals yourself so much anymore, I think insofar as advocacy groups are successfully producing people like this, they're also producing people who are more likely to be people who will care about wild animal suffering, as, you know, if they're confronted with the issue. So I think that kind of thing is useful. I think just what advocacy groups are already doing is useful. But I think there is some room for direct advocacy pertaining to wild animal suffering. But I think that it should be kind of done in a modest fashion. So I think what, insofar as anyone wants to, and there are some groups that are working directly on wild animal suffering right now. There's a growing segment of the effective altruism movement that is interested in wild animal suffering and is trying to raise awareness about it. And also trying to research interventions. If anyone who wants to look into it, if there's anyone who's interested in looking into this, two major effective altruism organizations that are working on wild animal suffering are Animal Ethics, a group called Animal Ethics, and a group called Wild Animal Initiative. And then to a lesser extent, also a group called Rethink Priorities is interested in wild animal suffering. But anyway, so these groups are not... These groups are not advocating for massive genetic interventions that would turn like carnivores into herbivores or our strategists into case strategists. They're usually advocating for other things, usually for more the sort of like medium scale interventions that I mentioned earlier. So things like vaccinating wild animals against diseases or trying to remove parasites that affect wild animals, so, you know, eliminate parasites or reduce parasite populations. And they advocate for other things too, but they tend to be more sort of like medium scale interventions. And I think that's good because it's much easier to get people on board with medium scale interventions that don't completely overhaul nature than it is to get them on board with really sort of dramatic ones. So I think I think they're doing the right thing right now. I think these groups are appropriately focusing right now on raising awareness about the severity and pervasiveness of wild animal suffering. And I think they're appropriately focused on advocating for sort of small and medium scale interventions rather than the really big dramatic ones.
Right. And I mean, it just occurred to me, you know, the dramatic ones in a way, I mean, this is kind of a conceptual issue. You know, nature stops being wild once we start intervening in those ways, right? I mean, in a way, it sounds like, you know, at least for the, you know, vaccinating wild animals is, you know, is one thing. Intervening in their genetics, even if it's just to, you know, keep them from suffering for the first 3 weeks of life, and then, you know, then they go back to normal, still seems to be a way of, like, actually, like, in effect, domesticating everything. is that at all a problem? Like, you know, we're already in this anthropogenic, or not anthropogenic.
Anthropocene?
The Anthropocene, yeah. Or whatever. Era where, you know, the entire globe is now, you know, essentially under our control, you know, in the sense of, you know, everything we do now is affecting the entire globe. There's no part of the globe that is not, implicated in, affected by human activity.
Yeah.
And that just sort of deepens the Anthropocene. And right. I just wonder if people would find that objectionable, just, you know, just from the get-go. And right. Maybe it's the artificial value of nature, or maybe it's just something else, like, you know, we have a moral obligation to stop suffering, but we also have an obligation not to, you know, stick our noses everywhere.
Right. Well, so I think that if one adopts the sort of view of nature that I argue for in the book, then you should have, in principle, you should have nothing against doing something like trying to remove our strategists' capacity to suffer for the first few weeks of their lives. And insofar as anyone does have an objection to that, there's a good chance that it's just because you haven't yet removed your sort of naturalness related intuitions from your brain, and you need to sort of adjust those intuitions over time or something like that. But I think one thing that's worth noting is that sometimes people get sort of confused two different things. It's easy to confuse, I think, naturalness with something like wildness or liberty for wild animals. So I think one thing that matters quite a lot, I think, is wild animals being free to live their lives. And when you think about domestication or putting animals in zoos or whatever, that sort of thing is objectionable. Domesticating animals or putting them in zoos is objectionable. And the reason it's objectionable is because you're interfering with their liberties to a large extent. Interfering with wild animals' liberties on a large scale is bad for wild animals. It's bad for, at least for competent wild animals, animals that are able to competently manage dangers of their environment. Such wild animals need their liberty to flourish.
Just to put it in the same point is, you know, we're very, very, very jealous of our own autonomy.
Right.
Right. I mean, autonomy, you know, the autonomy of each individual human is huge issue at every step of every, any ethical discussion.
Right.
And it seems like we are not treating wild animals the way we ought to if we are not granting that they too have autonomy.
Right. Yeah, no, so I think that that's right. But I think I'd note two things with respect to intervention in nature and its relationship with respect for wild animals' autonomy. One thing I think I'd note is that it's important to recognize that if we fully appreciate what the R strategy implies, most individual wild animals born into the world are not actually competent. They're not able to manage the dangers of their environment. And as a result, their liberty is not valuable to them, or it's not valuable to them at least until they develop competence, the competence necessary to successfully lead good lives on their own. Insofar as liberty matters at all, it's not going to be something that's going to prevent us from trying to help the really young R strategists who are dying after a week. I mean, we think with human children and whatnot, helping human children, even if it involves a lot of interference with their liberty, is fine as long as the interference stops at some point, right? At the point where they're able to competently manage the dangers of life. I'd take note of that. But also, I want to point out that when people think about large scale intervention in nature, usually what they initially have in mind is something like a large scale use of conventional wildlife management. So basically, turning nature into something that looks like a zoo. So pro- when I think, and that's initially what, when people in the earlier bits of the literature on wild animal suffering, often that's what authors had in mind. The large scale intervention was assumed to be a matter of doing something like fencing off predators from prey, restricting the liberties of predators to prevent them from attacking prey, diving in and maybe caring for Archstrategist offspring that can't care for themselves, and then sterilizing the other Archstrategists or whatever. These sorts of interventions, like really sort of manage wildlife management kind of interventions that look rather like turning nature into a zoo. I think that's often what people had in mind initially. And I think I agree that kind of scenario, a scenario where we've turned nature into a big zoo, is really counterintuitive. It might not be a good one. But that's not what I'm advocating for with gene editing. Gene editing involves some liberty infringement, some infringements on wild animals' liberties. But the only liberties it infringes upon are the liberties of animals who unfortunately have to be experimented upon for the sake of developing beneficent genetic interventions. With gene editing, we don't need to experiment on all wild animals or anything like that in order to give them beneficial genetically engineered traits. We only need to experiment on a very, very small subset of a target population. You can experiment on a few and then develop a laboratory population of maybe 100 animals or something like that. And after that, you can just release the animals into the wild, and those animals will pass on the genetically engineered trait to almost all of their offspring. They'll mate with other wild animals, they'll have offspring, and those offspring will have the trait. This is called doing a gene drive, and it's something that we're able to do with current genetic technology. We can make traits such that they will just get passed on to almost all offspring. And so we're not actually, if we do this gene editing approach, we're not actually turning nature into a zoo. We're not interfering with the liberties of all the wild animals in nature. We're only interfering with the liberties of those few animals who have to get stuck in a laboratory. And I agree that it's bad to experiment on animals, but I think that the severity of wild animal suffering justifies some moral costs.
Okay. We are over time at this point. So just to wrap up quickly, what are you working on now? Are you following up with further work on this issue or something else?
Oh, sure. I'm organizing a symposium about the book that I just talked about. It's going to be online, held over Zoom, I think, and it's sponsored by Apple. Apple's stands for Animals in Philosophy, Politics, Law, and Ethics. And it's a research group at Queen's. So I did my PhD at Queen's, and I'm an adjunct assistant professor there right now. And because I'm there right now, I'm also part of this research group. And it's a research group organized by Sue Donaldson and Will Kimlicka. And so we're going to be doing this symposium about the book, and hopefully we'll get the symposium papers revised and published afterwards. But that'll have to happen later. I'm also guest editing a topical collection for the Journal of Agricultural and Environmental Ethics, and it's a topical collection about positive duties to wild animals. It'll be a variety of papers about wild animal suffering. Some of which will be sort of more pro-interventionist, some of which are more conservative. Authors who have agreed to contribute include Jeff Sebo, Alistair Cochran, Angie Pepper, Oscar Orta, Katia Feria, Josh Milburn. I think that's all of them. Anyone who's listening who knows about the animal ethics and the people who are writing in it probably recognize some of those names.
Great. Okay. Well, I wish you luck with these endeavors, and I thank you for talking with New Books in Philosophy for a very interesting and provocative conversation about a provocative book. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Carrie. I appreciate it.